The main reason that they're trying to cover all this up is that Saddam Hussein was actually giving kickbacks to American oil companies and individuals for the oil that was being pumped in the Middle East. And he had a very definite and direct commercial relationship with none other than George Bush. George Bush was getting kickbacks.
One thing we do know for sure, though, in the East Helena area, that the smelter itself, after 100 years of smelting, has deposited considerable amounts of cadmium, lead, and arsenic on the area, and it's also been responsible for contaminating the air.
The numbers of rapes has been stepped up dramatically in Kuwait since the liberation of Kuwait, and they're now reporting, as of the beginning of August, an average of 20 rapes a day.
They're really practicing essentially sort of the same sales pitch that the old Anaconda Company practiced in the state of Montana for about 80 years. What these guys are using for their sewage plant is the groundwater in the river.
There are many different types of rape. It can come from many sources, and many can be the victims. We'll look at the variety of rape right now on Alternative Views. Many different rapers in the world. It may be the fellow lurking behind the bush, it may be the person you're on a date with, it may be your cellmate, but it can also be a corporate head, somebody in an intelligence agency, or another government official. We'll look at lots of different types of rape, rape of the environment, through a wonderful documentary called Shame on Montana by Gene Barnofsky. He shows what the corporations have been doing in the rape of the environment in that state. We also will take a look at rape against women and rape by bankers. But first, let's take a look at alternative sources for information about the Soviet Union.
During the recent attempt at a coup d'etat in the Soviet Union, I discovered a new bulletin board on the PeaceNet database service called Northwest News. This was initiated in Leningrad in the spring of this year to send alternative information from the Soviet Union to the West. It was initiated by a group in Leningrad called the Northwest Information Agency that was giving information about what was going on in Leningrad, the Baltic Republics, and the north of Russia, different from the official news transmitted by the Soviet Union. And this was an incredibly valuable source of information during the Russian coup, because it was really the only source of alternative information in Russia, because the coup people actually blocked all of the communications to the west from Russia, except from Moscow. For some reason, CNN was able to transmit instantaneously, practically, all of the action of Boris Yeltsin and the Soviet parliament that was resisting the coup. Plus, Yeltsin was able to get fax information all over Russia because they didn't cut certain domestic telephone lines. On the other hand, they cut a lot of communication services off, these Stalinists who did the coup. They burned a lot of the faxes at different dissident headquarters all over the country. They put an electrical surge of power that burned up a lot of computer and fax networks. And supposedly the only one that survived was this Northwest Information Agency. I went back and read through the entire year to see what sort of news they were reporting. And the most interesting news they were reporting concerned the Russian Green Party, that's an environmentalist party in the Soviet Union, that was exposing a lot of crimes, environmental crimes, by some of the Communist Party organizations, theft of timber and other resources by private entrepreneurs who were utilizing contacts in the government. In fact, the Green Party was exposing so many of these crimes that they were having their buildings bombed periodically, and occasionally some of their party leaders would get beaten up, quite violently, and they would have their lives threatened. Well, once the coup started, the Northwest Information Agency was sending information on an hourly basis to the West that indicated a lot of forms of resistance to the Stalinist coup in Leningrad and the northwest of Russia. In fact, all through Russia, they were getting information that they were transmitting to the West. So the resistance didn't just take place through Boris Yeltsin and the Soviet Parliament and folks in Moscow who were resisting the coup. In fact, resistance in Leningrad was much greater than the resistance in Moscow. Almost no official agency cooperated during the coup in Leningrad. For instance, the city and regional council called a meeting the first day of the coup and unanimously agreed to support Yeltsin's resolution to resist the coup that they declared illegal and unconstitutional and to restore the legitimate constitutional government. They also agreed to the call for a general strike that Yeltsin put out, and there was very little answer to Yeltsin's strike in Moscow and a lot of parts of the country, but in Leningrad there was a very significant and widespread general strike. Right after the Soviet meeting in Leningrad, they sent workers sent their representatives to the factories to get the workers to stop. The police refused to cooperate with the coup plotters. The second day that they had a Soviet meeting in Leningrad to resist the coup, the head of police came in saying that the police in Leningrad would resist any attempt by the Soviet military to try to take over the city, and he got a standing ovation and is now a hero of Leningrad. In fact, at one point, they had an army unit that began to move on Leningrad. It got 30 kilometers from the city, and it just stopped. In fact, they had a meeting of Soviet military mothers in Leningrad, where each one of the mothers sent telegrams to their sons telling them not to fire on the Russian people to resist the illegal coup d'etat.
There are two scenarios, one which harks back to an interview we had with a professor friend of ours from Rutgers University. Professor Bronner said a key thing would be whether the KGB and the army would stand aside and let the political process work itself out, or whether they would intervene. And so either they decided to do that, not to intervene, or another scenario is they were too weak and divided and they could not, and too disorganized, and the morale was so bad that they could not intervene even if they wanted to. Was there any indication of this on the PeaceNet thing?
This was communiques from the grassroots level. It wasn't really an analysis of what they think happened from this Leningrad group. I indicated that the mothers of the soldiers were resisting and that the army units around Leningrad refused to move in on that city. And actually, the New York Times had fairly complete analyses of what happened with the KGB and the Soviet military, and it's simply they were split. That a elite unit of the KGB was supposed to rush the so-called White House where Yeltsin and the Russian parliament was meeting, and they were supposed to kill Yeltsin and every one of the deputies in there, and they simply refused to follow their orders. And the army itself was split. We saw on television one major unit go over to the side of the resistance, and CNN also reported on a lot of ex-soldiers, Afghan veterans, other retired soldiers, who all showed up with their weapons at the Russian parliament. And the other remaining military people that were following the instructions of the coup just didn't have the heart to attack their comrades, and so they just simply disobeyed orders to attack. There was only a couple of young soldiers who fired on the crowd and in some cases ran over a couple people and killed them with their tanks or light armored vehicles. But on the whole, the rank and file military and a lot of the middle level, and in some cases with the Air Force and Navy, high level officers simply refused to follow the orders of the coup plotters. And even in the KGB, there was some resistance to the coup. So basically, they just didn't have it together. They had some high leaders on these significant organs, like the KGB and the military and the Interior Ministry and other agencies of the Communist Party, but they didn't have the rank and file and the mid-level bureaucrats in these institutions, most of whom were filled with perestroika Gorbachev reformers. So this was the brilliant thing that Gorbachev did, was to get his people not always on the highest levels of these institutions, but he got enough of them in it. So when the coup, you know, came down, there was resistance from within. So this was fascinating to read the amount of resistance that took place all over the Soviet Union. About 2 or 3 days into the coup, the Leningrad group started getting reports from cities all over the Soviet Union that were giving indications that there was major resistance everywhere. It's interesting to know how they got this information out of the Soviet Union. In almost the entire country, the coup plotter shut down international telephones. Only in Latvia were they able to maintain international phone communication with the West. So what the Leningrad group did, the Northwest Information Agency, was to send by fax their information to some comrades in Latvia, who then sent it to PeaceNet and indeed all over the Soviet Union and all over the West to indicate the degree of resistance there was from the beginning throughout the country to the coup. So the media here pretty much made Boris Yeltsin and some of his associates the heroes of resistance, but indeed it was all over the country that the Stalinist coup was resisted and democracy was saved in the Soviet Union. And you could only find this out through reading this alternative information. You did not get this story from CNN or the New York Times or the mainstream media.
Is there anything from the PeaceNet which gives an indication of the relative popularity or power of Yeltsin versus Gorbachev?
No, but everything that I gleaned from this, as well as from the New York Times and CNN, indicates that in Moscow, Gorbachev's popularity is almost nil, whereas in other parts of the country, Gorbachev has a mixed reception. He's much more popular than Yeltsin. Yeltsin is not popular outside of Moscow because the other republics fear domination by Moscow and Russia, and they don't like Yeltsin anyway so much outside of Moscow, where he's absolutely a hero. He's just worshipped there. So Gorbachev still has a fair amount of power or popularity in the country, although there's also throughout the country a lot of blaming him for the troubles of the country. So I suspect if there was a nationwide presidential election today and anyone, Shevardnadze or anyone that was well known, ran against Gorbachev, they'd probably beat him.
Wow.
So Gorby's days are numbered.
He's really a tragic figure. He was devoured by his own child after the child grew up.
But I basically still give him credit for perestroika. He was the guy that started it. He was the one that kept the process going between the hardline party people on the right and the radical democratic reformers on the left. He kept the right from taking over much earlier and eradicating the reformers when they could have done it.
Yeah.
Because they didn't. So Gorbachev bought time, created institutional space to make this reform possible. And although he wasn't willing to go as far as the reformers like Yeltsin, he still got it started and carried it forward. And he probably thought that he was going as fast as he possibly could, that if he tried to go any faster, he would have been overthrown and you would have gone back to Stalinism. So I give Gorbachev much more credit for this whole process of democratization in the Soviet Union than most of the commentators who seem eager to dump on it.
As the people in Eastern Europe are overthrowing the institutions which have been raping them for many years, we take a look at some of the kinds of rape which are rampant in the United States: sexual rape and violence toward women. Sonia Johnson, a feminist who was excommunicated from the Mormon Church for supporting the Equal Rights Amendment and who later ran for president on the Citizens Party ticket, recites some of the statistics on various forms of violence toward women.
Of the 28 million people in this country living in official poverty, 24 million are women and our kids. And by the year 2000, if this trend continues, and under Reagan it will not only continue but accelerate, the entire poverty population will be us and our kids. That's violence. And that 50% of women in relationships with men are beaten by them, that means anything from just a slap in the face to murder. And that one out of three women can expect to be raped in her lifetime. And that one out of four women under the age, or girls or females under the age of 18, before they reach age 18, will be sexually abused, incestually abused by some member of their family, their father, or grandfather.
One out of four?
One out of four.
Yes, I've seen that.
One out of four. It's absolutely an epidemic. It's an epidemic out there, and so is rape. Do you realize that there are more than 2,000 rapes a day in this country? That, I think, is an extremely low figure.
That doesn't include marital rape either, does it?
No, of course not. Those are not even part of the statistics. And so when I say there's a war on against us, and when I say that if we can't stop rape, just rape, and let's not talk about incest or battering or economic violence, if we can't stop rape in the streets of one U.S. city, how can we hope to stop, have peace in the world? If we can't stop this war against half of us by the other half, we don't even know what peace is all about. We haven't got a clue. What the nature of it is, how you go about having it, that it begins, that's one of the reasons the women's movement is central. It's saying, really, look right here. We are fighting a war and have been for 5,000 years waging war. So all you people in the peace movements, don't look out there and look at the nuclear weapon. Look right here in your own homes, in your own streets, and say, how do we have peace amongst one another? How do we love women? How do we treat them as if they weren't our enemies?
There is an article, an old article in the Dallas newspaper, the Cold Syndicate, written by Louis Grizzard, or Grizzard, about a rape case in which, it was in Fort Lauderdale, in which a woman was raped by a 26-year-old man. The jury acquitted him because, in the words of the jury foreman, he said the victim advertised for sex. Well, what did this woman do to advertise? Well, she was publicly dressed in a sea green tank top and ruffled miniskirt, and she didn't have any panties on. So that was enough, according to the jury, to acquit the guy. Well, the author says, now, just because she's advertising for sex doesn't mean she's advertising for sex for you. She could be advertising for sex with a boyfriend who's going to meet her later, maybe her husband. Maybe she's hoping to find a movie producer there, but it doesn't mean that guy had justification for raping the woman. All the jury needed to know was, did she want to have sex with the creep who raped her? Obviously not. Did the man force her to have sex with him? That was the other thing that was only necessary for the jury. Well, obviously, she did not want to have sex with him, and he forced her to. So, what does this say to all the other potential rapists and the same guy? The next time he sees a woman dressed in a sea green tank top and ruffled miniskirt, he said, hey, I can rape her. I got off once. Better check CVA panties first, perhaps, so the jury will acquit me on this. And finally, Lewis Grizzard says, just because you're wearing dancing shoes don't mean you want to dance. And just because a woman isn't wearing underwear doesn't necessarily mean she's there for the taking.
One of the legacies of the Persian Gulf War is a war on women in Kuwait. The numbers of rapes has been stepped up dramatically in Kuwait since the liberation of Kuwait, and they're now reporting, as of the beginning of August, an average of 20 rapes a day of Kuwaiti women. Actually, it's mostly Philippine and Chinese and other women who work as domestics who are getting raped at an alarming number. And most of the reported rapes to the hospitals in Kuwait claim that it was Kuwaiti soldiers in uniform who are responsible for the greatest number of the rapes of women.
With the stories about rapists being acquitted and women being raped massively in Kuwait, recalls to mind a situation about a year ago. You remember when the women were killed down in Gainesville, Florida?
Right.
About a week or two before and a week or two after, I noticed in the papers, in the Austin papers and other papers in the country, that there would be stories about a woman raped here, an 8-year-old girl found beheaded in either in Austin or San Antonio, another woman was killed in there, and two other women killed here or there. On the West Coast, women were being killed in different cities. Just little stories. But it reminded me of the fact that there is massive destruction of human beings in this country. They just happen to be the wrong gender. If these people being killed were politicians, baseball players, police, males, there have been a big to-do about it. There have been investigations. There have been money, more money given to police and all like this. But, after all, nobody paid any attention to this, the fact that there's something all happening all over the country, because it's only happening to women.
And there's been several incidences of serial killing of homosexuals that just weren't investigated, weren't taken seriously by the police. So that's another category of people that are just routinely victimized in this country, and no one seems to care.
But people do care about another type of rape, the rape of the environment. Such a person is Gene Barnofsky of Missoula, Montana. And here is his documentary about the environmental rape in his state. There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth, every common sight to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream. It is not now, as it hath been of yore, turn wheresoever by night or day, the things which I have seen I now can see no more. This is the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness of northwest Montana. Claims to mine this wilderness have been approved by the U.S. Forest Service. ASARCO and ORANDA will remove 30,000 tons of wilderness every day for up to 30 years.
It seems sad to see that every time they have to have one of these facilities for a mine, it's always located right next to a creek. the one that's being proposed for the Southern Cabinets, the Rock Creek Project, is going to be right adjacent to Rock Creek. And Rock Creek, it's a stone's throw, maybe 200, 300 yards from the Clark Fork River itself. And my concerns there are that this facility right here is in what I would call a real decrepit condition. Nobody knows what's going on inside the tailings pond. Nobody's making the effort to determine what's going on in the inside, and yet we're having another facility that's exactly the same as this being proposed right down in that neck of the woods, you know. And for anybody that's never been down to Lake Pendere, the Clark Fork empties right into Lake Pendere, and that's one of the crown jewels of the Pacific Northwest out here. And I personally feel that, boy, if this facility here can't be operated properly, we have no business. ASARCO has no business. The state has no business giving them a permit to start operating another such facility. Water's the elixir of life. You don't live long without it.
At one time, the president of Anaconda was the governor of Montana. They've always been oriented toward pleasing mining companies. And I think that mentality has come down to this day. The whole attitude in Helena is the mining companies are to be pleased. ASARCO asked the state if they could stop monitoring in Lake Creek, the creek that drains the whole drainage. They could stop monitoring for iron, manganese, and sulfate. And the state said, yes. The state agencies simply don't want to enforce the water quality laws. Their attitude is steeped in the history of Montana. When the president of Anaconda was the governor of Montana, you please the mining companies, you do what they say, and don't ask too many questions. And that attitude controls the thinking of any personnel in Helena. As soon as a problem would arise, an indication in the monitoring of a possible water quality problem, ASARCO would ask the state, we don't want to monitor there, or we don't want to monitor for that anymore, and the state would comply. The tailings pond has developed several seeps which are pouring directly into Lake Creek, and they're high, especially in iron, manganese, and sulfate. And those three elements are classical indicators of acid mine drainage problems. And so it causes one to suspect that the tailings pond and the sulfide minerals within it are developing acid mine drainage, which is a very serious problem for the future. The Water Quality Bureau is responsible for water quality issues, but the Department of State Lands has the ultimate authority. And whenever ASARCO wants anything to be shoved under the table, they ask the Department of State Lands, and the Department of State Lands has the authority, even if the Water Quality Bureau objects. It's a tragedy to the wilderness, the small amount of wilderness that we have, to see a mine going in. And the metals are lead, copper, arsenic, cadmium, silver, zinc. They're very, very toxic metals that degrade the water, that degrade the life in the water at extremely, extremely low concentrations. So we have to take into account how much lead, how much copper, how much arsenic is going downstream, and we need to be responsible for those hundreds of pounds of lead and arsenic and copper going down the stream. Where are they going? And what are they going to, what kind of life are they going to interfere with? Wherever. You know, we can't just be responsible for this little 10 feet of river. We're responsible for the whole river.
see the moss in my right hand and the vegetation still alive. It's still green. And the one on the left is dying. It's turned brown already. Contaminated with the mine tailings from the mine. Coming down from the Landusky mine.
From my perspective, as an employee of the Department of Health's Air Quality Bureau, I believe there is a potential health risk in the East Helena area. I have to admit, though, there has not been any great amount of direct evidence of direct health effects on the people. Studies that were done earlier have only shown that one child actually in the area had elevated blood lead levels. One thing we do know for sure, though, in the East Helena area, that the smelter itself, after 100 years of smelting, has deposited considerable amounts of cadmium, lead, and arsenic on the area, and it's also been responsible for contaminating the air.
The Azarka smelter in East Helena ranks 41 out of the Environmental Protection Agency's 500 worst toxic waste sites.
They claim there's a lot of lead now, but I don't think there is. It hasn't hurt us. We are 100% for the smelter. We want it to keep on running.
The people of East Helena, Montana, have been warned by the Department of Health not to eat their garden vegetables, which are contaminated with lead, arsenic, and cadmium from the Azarko smelter.
I feel that there definitely is a problem day to day. For a number of years, since lead and other heavy metals have been tested in East Helena gardens, have consistently found that they are higher.
Azarko is no patriotic American corporation. Azarko has no loyalty to this country or any country. Azarko is loyal to one thing, and that's called profit. They don't care about you. They don't care about America. They don't care about your rights or freedoms. All they care about is making money.
My name is Jake Krylik, and I've been working in the Kootenai National Forest for the last 3 years as a tree planter. And since then, I've become increasingly irate with the U.S. Forest Service's mismanagement of this forest. Tonight's hearing, the DEIS on the Noranda-Montanor project, is the most recent example of the Forest Service and the state of Montana's total disregard for the Cabinet Mountain ecosystem, and also an indication of their unbending loyalty to large multinational corporations. It seems to me that this is just another quick fix designed to save Libby's economy. I don't believe that these corporations, Noranda and also Azarko, will give Lincoln's County a shot in the arm. A closer look at these companies will reveal that their intent, beyond extracting millions of tons of ore, is also to extract the profits and take them elsewhere. The temporary jobs that are created will neither stabilize nor sustain Libby's economy. Higher housing prices and increased costs of doing government business will, in my mind, make Libby a less attractive place to live. My true feelings are that the Cabinet Mountains are the backbone of Libby. You look right out and you see it. And to me, also of the region in general. To jeopardize the ecological health of these mountains is to remove the vitality not only of the natural communities, the plant and animal communities, but also of the human community that lives at the base of these mountains. I would argue that Noranda and the agencies involved have not proved to me or to anybody else that they can protect the biodiversity, the water and the air quality, the wilderness integrity, or the recreational opportunities in the cabinets. Therefore, I don't think that they should be granted a permit. To me, the values and qualities that I just described will sustain Libby far longer than Noranda or Azarko ever will. Thank you.
Well, my history with the Sarco and the grizzly bear and the western Montana goes way back to before Sarco came to the area when the proposal was put forward. I knew a Sarco. I knew they weren't a good outfit, and I wrote this letter, in fact, to the Missoulian saying that we should not welcome them to Montana because they had a worldwide reputation that was very, very poor. I said they'll do nothing but bring grief to Montana and to the grizzly bear and to wilderness and to the quality of life in Montana. They, of course, got very angry about that.
Sarco has a horrible environmental history. You can look at the record of the state of Idaho. You can look at it in Colorado. You can look at it at their smelters that they've had at Tacoma, Washington, and their current lead smelter in Helena. All of them have regularly violated environmental laws. You can add to that that they are the owners of about 12 Superfund hazardous waste sites in the United States. You can see that, as well as a part owner of an asbestos company that has got quite a few lawsuits pending against it. Environmental protection is obviously not a real high priority with the Sarco, and that, frankly, in our estimation of the mining industry in the region, is that they're kind of at the bottom of the barrel in terms of making environmental concerns a corporate priority. There's some companies that are coming around, to Sarco isn't.
So the protective things in terms of the habitat have not been dealt with properly. The Cabinet Wilderness, which is a very important unit of wilderness, has never been expanded and designated properly by the Forest Service. They refuse to take the responsibility as the leading land management agency in the area to safeguard the grizzly against these additional mining impacts. The research hasn't been done. The state and the federal government are responsible for documenting the status of the habitat and the status of the bear. They've done it, but they've done it in a very low-key way compared to research elsewhere in the state. And it's quite clear to me that there's been enormous economic and political pressure on the two key agencies, the State Fish and Game and the U.S. Forest Service, to butt out when it comes to Cabinet Mountains, when it comes to Sarco, when it comes to Narando, and when it comes to the status of the grizzly bear in that area. At least 10 years ago, I said, look, if we aren't going to do the job right, let's delist the grizzly bear and kiss him goodbye in that area. Let's not pretend. Let's not make all kinds of fake statements and fake policies and such. If we really mean what we want the grizzly bear in the area, let's do it right, and that's not been done.
Well, so when an outside company like a Sarco, a New York-based company, comes into the state and says, look, you guys, we can give you 350 jobs in 5 years, and if you don't give us any hassle about our pollutants, you'll see we're taking a page out of history in the state of Montana. When outside interest comes in here and says they're going to hire a bunch of people, a lot of people in the state put on blinders in terms of what some of the long-term environmental and social impacts of that proposal for jobs is going to be. It's happened time and time again. What I see happening with the Sarco's project and with other mining companies in this state, they're really practicing essentially sort of the same sales pitch that the old Anaconda company practiced in the state of Montana for about 80 years. Anaconda, of course, ran the state of Montana, ran the legislature, ran the newspapers for an awful long time. And now we have companies coming in with the same sales pitch: don't give us any trouble and you'll have some jobs. What these guys are using for their sewage plant is the groundwater in the river.
The Cabinet Mountains Wilderness in Montana is public land. It belongs to the American people. The U.S. Forest Service, however, has approved claims by Naranda and Asarco to mine this wilderness. The mining can only be stopped if Congress purchases the claims. You can notify your representatives and ask to have the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness removed from mining.
Miner's life is like a sailor board a ship to cross the waves. Every day his life's in danger, still he ventures being brave. Watch for rocks, they're falling daily. Careless miners always fail. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. Union miners, stand together. Heed no operator's tale. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. You've been breathing diesel fumes, and you've been loading 2-to-1. What have you to show for working since this mining life's begun? Overalls and silicosis, toxic water in your pail. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. Union miners, stand together. Heed no operator's tale. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. In conclusion, bear in memory, keep the password in your mind. God provides for every nation when in union they combine. Stand like men and linked together, victory we shall prevail. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. Union miners, stand together. Heed no operator's tale. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. Union miners, stand together. Heed no operator's tale. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. Bye, boys.
We've taken a look at two different types of rapes. Sexually against women, against the environment. But what about the banks, the intelligence agencies, arms dealers, and government officials? They also rape.
Josh Roden has an excellent analysis in the Christic Institute PeaceNet Bulletin Board on the Bank of Crooks and Criminals International, otherwise known as the BCCI scandal. New York Times columnist William Sapphire calls it the mega scandal of the underworld bank. Time magazine describes it as the largest corporate criminal enterprise ever, the biggest Ponzi scheme, the most pervasive money laundering operation and financial supermarket ever created. And New York District Attorney Robert Morgenthau calls it the largest bank fraud in history. Well, the article by Josh Roden focuses on the latest element of the scandal, which is that the Justice Department failed to investigate and prosecute the bank's officials despite strong evidence for years of wrongdoing. Sources have been telling the Justice Department ever since the early 1980s that the bank was involved in widespread corrupt activities, including money laundering, drug trafficking, illegal arms deals, fraud, embezzlement, extortion, bribery, you name it, the BCCI did it. Well, one of the witnesses that had been testifying to the Justice Department and didn't receive any hearing for years is William Robb, who's a Republican, who's a United States Customs Commissioner, who had been criticizing the Justice Department's handling of the BCCI money laundering case in Tampa, Florida, that ended in 1990 in January with a plea bargain that Robb called a shameless agreement. Well, Robb was dismissed from his duties because his superiors considered him overzealous and wanted him cut out of the BCCI investigation. Another person that had been doing government investigation for John Kerry into the BCCI scandal was Jack Blum, who's an investigative reporter who had worked for different government agencies for years. He testified about his own efforts to expose the bank, including risking his life in interviews with suspects from the bank. And Robert Morgenthau also said that he continued to give information to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department was telling his witnesses, the people that were giving testimony to him, not to cooperate with this New York City investigation. So it appears that the Justice Department did everything that they could in order to block investigations into BCCI's activities. Guess why? Well, it appears that the CIA was one of the many government agencies that was using BCCI in addition to terrorist groups that were funneling their money through BCCI drug operations such as Noriega. In fact, one of the things that I found out from this PeaceNet report was that one of the most mysterious aspects of the investigation involved all of the BCCI bank records from Panama City relating to General Noriega disappearing in transit to Washington while under heavy guard by the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Remember what John Stockwell said, that the Drug Enforcement Administration top officials, the very first ones, and the people who are still running the DEA were actually people who came from the CIA. And the DEA has offices around the world, and many of them are co-located with the CIA offices. As a matter of fact, when one group is out to lunch, the other group answers the phone. So they're not only the same people, they work very closely at different levels.
And so the DEA was just protecting its CIA buddies. It knew there was a lot of CIA operations going through this bank.
There is also, the Spotlight has some articles in which they've interviewed a Chicago journalist, Sherman Skolnick, who's been doing a lot of research into BCCI and also the American interlocks and connections with them. One of the banks which was very close to BCCI and operated with them hand and foot was Banca Nazionale del Lavoro, BNL. And guess who was on, until recently, the consulting board of BNL? None other than Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller.
And Brent Scowcroft, who's now Bush's national security advisor.
Also,
Henry B. Gonzalez did a lot of investigation of this Italian bank that was funneling all kinds of money and credits to Iran to buy weapons throughout the 1980s. It was a major source of funding for Saddam Hussein's military machine.
BCCI also was very active in political campaigns. Senator Kerry, who now is investigating BCCI, received $5,000 from the bank. And Michael Dukakis' campaign was receiving funds from BCCI. And Spotlight speculates that may be one of the reasons why the Reagan administration clamped down or try to clamp down on BCCI earlier, because they wanted to cut off that source of funding for the Dukakis campaign.
Well, they were playing both sides of the aisle. They also gave Jimmy Carter's foundation a lot of money. And, of course, Clark Clifford, who is probably one of the major Democratic power brokers behind the scenes, was involved with BCCI. They hired him as their counsel. He was the head of a bank that they took over, causing Clifford to finally resign in shame. But also, a lot of Republicans were involved with BCCI too, getting money from them, doing business with them. So this scandal involves all of Washington, from the CIA to the Democratic Party. So it'll just be interesting to see how much comes out, or when the cover-up hits in.
Well, there are three investigations which are going on. One by Senator Kerry, and that's always questionable just how much Senator Kerry is going to go after George Bush, because Senator Kerry is a fellow skull and bonesman, along with Georgie DeBush. The district attorney in New York,
Morgenthau,
Robert, he's trying to go after this situation. And Henry Gonzalez seems to be the person who is really going most rapidly and most aggressively about this. But the Justice Department is really not just dragging its heels on it. They're aggressively trying to shut off any type of inquiry into BCCI, because there are so many layers of operations in BCCI. There is a so-called bank within a bank, and certain account names where millions and millions of dollars were either given to individuals or to operations of a shady nature. The big story, which this Sherman Skolnick of Chicago has come up with, and this is a wild one. Once again, it's one of those which Spotlight comes up with, and you wonder whether to believe it or not. But they said the main reason that they're trying to cover all this up is that Saddam Hussein was actually giving kickbacks to American oil companies and individuals for the oil that was being pumped in the Middle East. And he had a very definite and direct commercial relationship with none other than George Bush. George Bush was getting kickbacks. He said that Congressman Gonzalez was trying to get the bank records on this, and there is a court case being heard in the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Seventh Circuit of Chicago. It's called number 90, C-6863, the people of the state of Illinois, ex rel Willis C. Harris versus the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Gonzalez is trying to get the records of the Board of Reserve, of the Federal Reserve, relating to the operations of BCCI, the information which is contained in the Bank of England, which the Federal Reserve would have. And the this Skolnick says that the Justice Department has really come out and has tried to use a lot of muscle to try to keep the information that is being heard in the Court of Appeals from coming out. A court clerk let it slip out, or leaked the fact to Skolnick and others, that this was precisely what was happening in this case, and that one judge particularly was wanting to inform the American people, make these records public, so that they will know that all the time that George Bush was bad-mouthing Saddam Hussein and bombing Iraq, that there had actually been for years a very private and lucrative commercial relationship between the two. He says that this one judge has been, that the Justice Department has come down against this judge, saying they're going to release records and investigate him for corruption if he presses it any further, and that they're also trying to keep Gonzalez himself from getting any more information. But Skolnick did talk to the lawyers in the case who were trying to for Gonzalez and all, and the
Skolnick and asking me if this was the case, that there was a huge private deal between Bush and Hussein amounting to, you know, about $5 billion or so. And they were private deals. And the lawyer said, yes, you are absolutely correct, Mr. Skolnick. And Skolnick asked her, why is the bank commissioner so afraid that these records might be revealed? And the lawyer, the attorney, said, it might cause a run on the bank. It might cause a widespread lack of confidence in banks in general. It would cause a great political upheaval.
Well, what's fascinating is that this has been exposed to the maximum now in the East Bloc countries, in the previous Soviet Empire, and indeed now in the Soviet Union itself. People are breaking into KGB and Communist Party offices. They're getting documents. They're revealing all of the corruption, all of the criminal activities, all of the repressive activities. And in the United States, it's probably just as bad. And only some investigative reporters and alternative journals get the information out to the people.
Matter of fact, the activities of the CIA and their cohorts have been really either hushed up or tried to belittle them in the pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post. For instance, in spite of all that we've told you, here's what the New York Times had to say about while there are criminal investigations of the bank's operations, there's no evidence that the CIA or the bank acted improperly in any of the transactions for American intelligence operations.
Wow. Unbelievable.
And then the Washington Post says, it seems clear the BCCI was at least a frequent conduit, if not an outright collaborator, in questionable activities.
That's the understatement of the decade.
In questionable activities.
But were there to be an economic collapse or some act that caused the media to turn on George Bush and the CIA and Oliver North and the whole bunch of them that have been engaged in these activities for the last 10 to 30 years, there would be unbelievable revelations here in the United States.
But you know what I think is really happening in all of this is that there just is not a scandal here and a scandal there. What we're seeing is the window open up to the world, real world of intelligence and politics and economics.
Right.
And we're seeing the system as it really is working, as it really works all the time. The media and the government keep this from us normally. But this is an incredible thing that we're seeing. Hey, this is what is happening. This is the way the world really runs. All these interconnections, very complex things that happen. It goes on all the time, but we are not privy to it.
And that brings us to the end of another Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We also can provide you with information on how to get some of the publications by former CIA officer John Stockwell. We'd like to thank Kevin L. West, who was our camera person for our operation for Alternative Views this time, and particularly Gene Bernofsky of Missoula, Montana, who let us use his fine documentary, Shame on Montana. If you're interested in contacting Gene, if you have any questions or comments about the documentary, write to Worldwide Film Expedition, Box 7391, Missoula, Montana, zip code 59807. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. We get between 40 and 60 letters a week, and it's very nice to hear from viewers. So if you have any comments or questions, please write to us. Goodbye.